Hello and welcome to the Goldman Sachs pre-open macro call. This weekend, the call is hosted by myself, Mark Wilson, and we also have a section hosted by my colleague, Leah Larson, in investment banking. In light of Biden's exit from the presidential race, we're going to start this week with Steve Pastrick from our DC government affairs team. He's going to give us a deep dive into the political backdrop as Kamala Harris's campaign gears up. We're then going to bring in Ben Schneider, a senior strategist in our portfolio team, dissecting the trends we're seeing in the equity markets and some of the change in leadership and rotation and causes of the recent volatility. We're then going to bring in our TMT specialist sales, Pete Callahan, who's going to talk on big tech and the context and what we've learned from earnings. And then we're going to have European rates strategy discussed by George Cole, touching on the Fed and the BOJ. And then we're going to have Mike Cahill, our senior currency strategist, on dollar weakness, before finishing with Dan Struven, our head of oil research, to discuss recent price action there. Before we begin, can I just remind listeners that this call is for clients of Goldman Sachs only. If you are not a client, please could you hang up now? So we'll start with our first speaker, Steve Pastrick from our Office of Government Affairs. Steve, US Vice President Kamala Harris takes center stage now following Biden stepping down. As the endorsements and the donations pour in, can you just run us through procedurally what is the timeline now to confirmation? And then what do we know about Vice President and how is she polling?
Sure. Thank you. So the DNC Rules Committee met on July 24th to go through the process to ensure there's a smooth convention in Chicago at the middle part of August. The next thing to look forward to is a virtual roll call, which is expected sometime between August 1st and 7th. This would allow them to discuss the candidate to be officially locked up as the person who's going to go to the DNC convention in Chicago. And then looking forward ahead to the Chicago convention, which is the 19th to 22nd, that is when Vice President Harris will be officially nominated by the Democratic Party to be the candidate to run for president at this point. Now, in terms of your second question, in terms of polling and momentum following her elevation to be the nominee for the Democratic ticket, we have seen a number of national polls so far that have come in that are taken solely post her elevation and Biden's decision to drop out. And we've seen only a handful of swing state polls. So first on the national polls, there's been a clear moving to the center for the two candidates. And it appears that the two candidates are moving towards a more of a tied race. The average Real Clear Politics polling for Trump versus Harris has been a plus 1.7 for Trump. But of course, we've only had a handful of polls in the last week, so there are a lot more could change. In terms of swing state polls, the first polls were released at the end of this week, and they demonstrated that the lead for Trump in places like Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin has certainly narrowed. There are no states right now where Trump has widened his lead in terms of the swing state polls. But of course, this is just one poll. We expect to see more polls start to be released next week. And so the numbers will certainly change in terms of where support is fading and where support is growing. So for now, there's been a clear steadying of the ticket for Harris as the nominee, and the race has become much closer than it was 2 weeks ago.
Thank you for that, Steve. And then as we head closer to the election, what are you looking out for next? What are the key pieces of news? And importantly, who can we expect to be her running mate?
Sure. So, of course, you know, each poll and each national poll and state poll will be dissected in terms of what it means for both the candidacy and the down ballot races. So I would say that there are no large scale events that are going to happen until the debates, which could happen in September. But I think of note, we'll be looking through some of these polls and understanding where the independent vote is at, where the black vote is at, and where the Latino vote is at, and sort of understanding how those votes are changing from what they were Trump versus Biden 2 weeks ago to where they are now and how they compare both to that and the 2020 exit polls to see where there's actual strength and actual weakness for both candidates at this point too. In terms of running mate, there are a number of names that have been tossed out there. And the general consensus is that the Democratic Party is looking to find somebody who is from a swing state. So that would put you into the Josh Shapiro, the governor of Pennsylvania, or Mark Kelly, a senator from Arizona, or Democrats who currently are governors of Republican-held states, and that would put you at Roy Cooper from North Carolina and Andy Beshear from Kentucky. These are sort of the consensus for frontrunners. The Harris campaign released a list of 11 people earlier this week, and those people have started to be whittled off or say they don't want to run. But I think the four aforementioned candidates are largely viewed as frontrunners at this point.
Great. Thank you, Steve. Appreciate your thoughts. We're going to hear a lot more from you, I think, in weeks and months to come. Next, we're going to go to Ben Schneider. Ben is a senior strategist on our US portfolio strategy team. Ben, it's been a violent couple of weeks in terms of equity market rotation and price action. Small caps specifically have returned excess over large caps at a kind of record level. A lot of this seems to be driven by the building confidence in a September cut. How are rate expectations impacting equity market as you see it? And also, what are your thoughts and what does history tell us in terms of how we should be thinking about market outlook here, given the changing rate expectations?
Thanks, Mark. You're right. I think that the first catalyst here was interest rates, and that had two pretty important implications for the rotation. First is lower rates obviously puts less pressure on corporate balance sheets. And in particular, there's been a lot of focus by investors over the last couple of years on the fact that small caps have pretty high leverage, and in particular, one third of Russell 2000 debt is floating rate, for example, and that's about 5% for the S&P 500. So if you're reducing the cost of debt, you reduce that prioritization or that premium you would assign to strong balance sheets, and you can maybe pay a little bit less for a company that you were otherwise willing to own, but you were worried about its leverage. The second, of course, is if the Fed's going to cut, all else equal, that means easier financial conditions and therefore better growth. And not only do small caps tend to have more balance sheet leverage, they tend to be more cyclical and have a higher beta to the economy. And of course, this has reversed a little bit in the last few days with the market maybe incrementally pricing a worse growth outlook. But for the most part, over the last 2 weeks, we have seen various signs of equities pricing better growth. And that includes, you know, our pretty well-known pair of cyclical versus defensive baskets, with cyclicals dramatically outperforming, even within the large cap space. Now, that said, I don't think rates are the only catalyst. There's also politics, as Steve was just discussing. You know, the general consensus is that a Trump victory would be a positive for small cap stocks. That was certainly one of the clear rotations that took place in 2016. And then, of course, you know, a rotation has two legs to it. And not only have the small caps outperformed, but the largest stocks have pretty clearly underperformed over the last couple of weeks. And I think the biggest driver there is really concerns about the potential return on the massive wave of AI investment that we've seen over the last year or two. And of course, all of this has happened against a backdrop of very elevated market concentration. You know, physics terms, I like to analogize this to potential energy. Whether you're looking at hedge fund gross leverage, market concentration, valuation premia, there's just a lot of potential energy in the market. The things we were just discussing were the catalysts, and that led to this huge rotation. I think if you look forward, I think some of these catalysts are probably behind us. The market now is basically pricing our view for the Fed. We, for 2 years now, have been pretty substantially above consensus in terms of our forecast for US GDP growth. That's not really the case anymore. And arguably, if you look at the tools, the market is overpricing growth relative to our base case. So I think those macro tailwinds are mostly behind us. And it's pretty notable, if you look historically over the last few decades, we've seen many other episodes that went about 10%, like the rotation we've just seen, and lasted 1 to 2 months, you know, most recently at the end of 2023. So it wouldn't be abnormal for this just to end here. I think if you look at the exceptions, the one that lasted longer and went much further, they generally happen either because there was a massive acceleration in economic growth, which again is not our forecast, but it's certainly possible. And the other one, the other exception, of course, is the unwind of the tech bubble. And so ultimately, I think the most important catalyst over the next few weeks is going to be what we hear from the earnings season. You know, we've just kicked off the earnings season. So far, it's been pretty mixed. I wouldn't say the most encouraging signs, but we're still not even halfway through. So a lot of data points ahead of us.
And Ben, you picked up on the election there. Obviously, there has been a little bit of an increase in uncertainty. The market doesn't like uncertainty. What are the implications as you see it as the election debate evolves? And then also, what are the key political issues from both Trump and Harris that you see becoming key points of discussion for the market?
Yes, you're right, Mark. Regardless of what the polls say, it's pretty clear uncertainty is high, and history and the calendar tell us it's probably going to remain high for the next few months. And all else equal, that's not a great catalyst if you're thinking about the equity risk premium or about the propensity for investors to incrementally allocate capital to equity. So that is a challenge. I think in terms of policy, there's really been three dynamics that have been in focus in my investor conversations. First is the potential impact on growth of changes in fiscal policy, particularly given the potential tax cuts that have been discussed by Trump. Second would be changes in regulation. And third would be the potential for what some call America First policies, which is most notably tariffs, but also includes potentially some changes in immigration, geopolitical issues, among others. And these could not just affect risk premium and valuation, but also really have material impacts on earnings growth and on the macroeconomic backdrop with regards to inflation. And so I think if you look across that spectrum, it's not really clear that one candidate or one party is massively positive for equities and the other is massively negative. It's really a mixed picture. And I think while the broad market impact is muddy, the real clear signal is a rotational signal. So similar to the discussion we were just having, and you've seen some of these play out recently. So if I had to highlight one, it would be that the likelihood of a Trump victory would be supportive of domestic facing US stocks compared to their peers that have more international revenues or more international supply chains. This is based on both growth stimulus potentially, on trade policy, on a whole host of factors. This was a very clear rotation during the first Trump administration. It's been very correlated with prediction markets in the last few months. And not only does it drive baskets, for example, that we've built around the geographical location of stock revenues, but also this small cap trade that we've seen so far. And it's not that tariffs are good for small caps or that large caps don't benefit from economic growth and tax cuts. But if on the margin, if you're thinking about who are the relative winners and who are the relative losers of these potential policies, they would probably be better for small caps than for the mega cap tech stocks, for example. Now, all that said, just as I mentioned earlier with the small cap rotation and earnings, here too, it's still very early. I like to remind clients that the first debate and all of the headlines that have come since have all taken place in basically the last month, and we still have over 3 months to go. And the 50 or 60% probability that the markets are currently giving to Trump in prediction markets, that's a long way from 100. So I think we will see a lot of volatility over the next few months. And I should also note that in discussions with equity investors in particular, there's been a huge amount of focus on all these things. And it's undeniable that there have been rotations in the market that have been well correlated with political odds. But for the most part, I don't think many investors are actively rotating their portfolios right now based on politics, which does come back to that point on uncertainty you made up top.
Great. Thank you very much, Ben. Our next speaker is Pete Callahan. Pete is our US tech sector specialist. Pete, a lot of focus coming into this last week was on earnings and what we were going to learn. We had Tesla and Alphabet report. So maybe you could just take us through what we learned from key reports that we've had so far, but also just given the tumultuous price action, if you could just give us your thoughts on the setup as you see it now for large cap tech also.
Yeah, thanks, Mark. To pull that question apart, first on price action, it's certainly a choppy week. I think midweek, the NASDAQ had its worst day in over 18 months. And so just to double click on kind of what happened and what sort of stood out to me all week long was no one really had a single answer. Everybody just sort of had a mosaic of views and feedback that kind of drove it. But a couple of things that maybe I would highlight would be one, of course, just more simple risk off, degrossing, long selling, et cetera. That's kind of one element of this. I would say two, there tends to be pockets of tension that grow. And right now it's certainly grown a little bit louder of this kind of gap between AI investment and AI monetization. And I think Alphabet on their conference call talked about, in their case, the risk of underinvesting being larger than the risk of overinvesting, meaning they really need to get this right. And kind of had comments around this will take time, but like we view this as a important multi-year journey for us. Between those comments that we heard last week, I think the market starts to wonder a little bit just about what's going to be the visibility and the linearity of the spending and monetization cycle in the quarters and years to come. I don't think that was a tactically informative takeaway, but I think it sort of resonates and pulls with investors at times, particularly when things feel a little bit stretched from a positioning perspective. And then I would say probably the third thing that jumped out at me was just this ongoing kind of gap between, let's call it Mag 7, Gen AI momentum, which has been very strong, and then kind of the quote unquote rest, right? The pile of data points across consumer or auto and industrial end markets that have piled up and started to tilt a little bit more negatively. And there is no doubt that these large cap tech companies certainly have some degree of cyclicality in them, whether it's advertising or cloud or sort of consumer spending. And because of that, I think the market at times also gets anxious around the sustainability of that gap. And that did flare up last week as well. I do think the big picture is important here, Mark. We've probably talked about this in the past and sent this data around, but the truth is these earnings prints for these large cap tech stocks, at least as measured by T plus one, it isn't exactly historically an amazing stretch for these names, right? Tesla sold off 12% midweek on its print, but frankly, it's been down 10% on five of the last six prints. Google was down 5% last week on its print. It's actually sold off 5% on three of the last four prints. And of course, these large cap stocks are great stocks over the recent history. And so it's almost a you own them despite the
tax
earnings prints
questions.
And reactions.
Submitting a tax correction is essential to ensure that your tax return.
Just quickly on the fundamental side, Mark, a couple of things I would highlight. Alphabet did reaccelerate their search revenue growth ex the leap day. And I think given their $300 billion revenue base, it's worth flagging that they didn't really have any negative callouts at a macro level. They did flag tougher second half comps, which is well understood by the market, but no big callouts macro-wise. I would say two, there is signs of perhaps some stability in software spending. Think results from SAP or ServiceNow or Google Cloud or even IBM software segment. I don't think we have enough data points here for investors to feel fully confident re-engaging in software yet, but at least we have a few that we can point to. And then I guess I would say on the third point, the companies continue to demonstrate an ability to drive some level of margin on top of the revenue growth. And so Alphabet delivered very strong operating margins this past quarter. These companies continue at the moment to demonstrate an ability to offset ramping CapEx and depreciation with some level of cost cutting. This, of course, is a very big debate for these stocks in the second half of this year and into 25.
Thanks, Pete. And then with an item next week, we've got an even bigger week of earnings. What are you expecting from the rest of the mega cap names to report next week?
Yeah, that's right. We have Microsoft, Meta, Amazon, and Apple all reporting next week. Just a couple things to listen for. One, CapEx commentary on the go forward. That'll be important, of course, for the semiconductor stocks and of kind of important as a sort of a demand indicator for AI broadly, i.e., if you're spending more, the market's assumption is because there's more demand for it. Microsoft may give some color ahead of their fiscal 25, which kicks off. And so that'll be really important. I would say two is just the durability of the public cloud trends. Think about Azure and AWS. We got a reacceleration from Google. If this can continue, I would view this as a good leading indicator, both for broad-based enterprise spending, but also for generative AI adoption. I would say three, any clues around AI monetization? Of course, this is the big, big debate on everyone's mind. Microsoft could perhaps talk about their co-pilots. Meta has an AI tool, which they talked about last quarter, having tens of millions of users trying it. We could hear some commentary around cloud contribution from AI. So that'll be really important for people. And then, of course, the last thing would just be the health of the consumer, right? The Amazon Prime consumer and the Apple high-end consumer generally being viewed as perhaps more durable than some of the data points we've seen elsewhere the last few weeks. And so investors will be looking for that to remain true.
That's great. Thank you very much, Pete. I'm now going to hand over to Leah. Leah is a partner in the investment banking division.
Thanks, Mark. Just a reminder that I'm on the private side of the firm. I won't be sharing any MNPI, and I'm not soliciting or recommending that any investor take any action. Also note that the views expressed by my guests are theirs and not the views of investment banking. And with that, I'd like to welcome George Cole onto the call. George is our head of European rate strategy in our global macro group. George, thanks for joining us. First question for you, despite solid U.S. activity data, markets have continued to embrace the prospect of a near-term Fed cut amid lower inflation and dovish Fed speak. So with the front end now pricing in about 65 bips for the year, how does that compare both to your expectations for the Fed and to other G10 front ends, especially in Europe where fewer cuts are priced, but the data is looking weaker?
Thanks very much, Leah. So I think that's really pointed out a topic of conversation for clients that we're really engaged with. The fact that you have seen over the last month or so a pretty significant rally in the US front end that has been on the back of progress in the labor market, so a slowing of the pace of jobs growth, ongoing, very gradual and not alarming, but gradual increases in the unemployment rate to the point where it does look like once you got the downside surprise to the latest CPI, you really did seem to have a much more balanced outlook on both the inflation front and the labor market. And it has been confirmed with a number of Fed speakers that that has led to a little bit of a shift in Fed communication toward pointing the prospects of a cut. And I think that the front end is pricing almost nothing for next week's meeting. So I think we're still operating on a model where the Fed is going to signal a cut in advance and would have given a clearer signal for the July meeting. We haven't received that. And so in a sense, the market is really pricing that with a very low probability. But you have seen the meeting subsequently, and especially September, really pricing quite richly. You're pricing the full 25 basis point cut by September, and indeed, depending on the day, maybe even a little bit more than that. And in part, that's probably a function of the fact we're not pricing much risk for July at all, and the model really is that you're going to get handheld toward that cut. That does mean that the market has pretty strong expectations, I'd say, that the Fed will guide toward the cut next week. That's probably not such an unreasonable expectation. We agree September is the likely timing for the first cut. We're expecting two for the year, so one in September, one in December. So the market is pricing, as you say, a little bit more than that. That also seems reasonable given the asymmetry. If the data were to weaken, the labor market were to slow or cool, or the unemployment rate rise in subsequent readings, that probably would bring into play faster easing and maybe consecutive cuts. So the pricing doesn't look particularly incorrect. But it also doesn't look like a very tempting buy either. And the reason is, the recent activity data that you mentioned has actually been pretty good in the US, whether it's retail sales or GDP growth. And so in a sense, I think this is a moment where the market has shifted focus. Now that inflation has come off a little bit back to the growth picture, it has looked certainly in global terms that things are a little bit weaker, and the US front end, is kind of responding to that broad shift in the growth outlook. What I think, though, is the case, given our relatively upbeat forecast for growth in the remainder of the year, I think it's going to be a little more difficult for the front end in the US to really outperform. And so although pricing doesn't look wrong, it doesn't look particularly attractive to buy either. I think that in comparison to the other G10 front ends, this focus on growth is something that we're seeing in other central banks and economies as well. The Bank of Canada last week, I think, were a good example where, if anything, the spot inflation news has been a little bit higher. They took their 24 forecasts up a little bit, and yet they did point toward the downsides risks to the outlook. They pointed to cooling in the labor market, weakness in GDP. And as a result, we've actually shifted to a much more dovish view on the Bank of Canada that they can cut consecutively. So I think this is a really important point to remember, that ultimately we've been in this last 6 months laser focused on inflation. Is it going to be possible for G10 central banks to cut? In the end, a spot inflation surprise doesn't really carry that much information for where inflation will be in 2 to 3 years' time. In contrast, growth really does. So where you're seeing the weakness in growth, that's where the front end can move a lot further. Another example, RBNZ, they've recently introduced an easing bias. There'll be a lot of focus in the coming weeks on labor market data there to see what that does for their outlook. The final comment I would make is the front end that seems to be lagging this new growth news is in Europe. Our European economics team have taken their growth forecasts down. That's on the basis of very significant weakness in the recent PMIs, at least in contrast to the better news we'd seen in some of those surveys earlier in the year. The French election, although it's cooled or relaxed as a risk for broader Europe, is still probably going to create enough uncertainty to weigh on European growth. On French growth in particular. And then, of course, the tariff risk associated with the US election. Of course, nothing is certain in that regard, but it does create some downside risk for growth in Europe. And that makes the front end to us a pretty attractive buy. At the moment, the ECB are very much focused on inflation, but we think their attention will increasingly turn toward the growth downside risks.
Thanks, George. Now, just turning to Japan, as we look towards the Bank of Japan's upcoming policy meeting, what can we expect from policymakers, and particularly in the context of recent moves in the yen?
Well, so this meeting, I mean, I think it's been well flagged by the BOJ. There will be some announcement, almost certainly, on quantitative tightening. So this is on the balance sheet. How are they going to manage their portfolio of JGBs that they own? That really is an enormous portfolio as a share of GDP compared to the other central banks. So this will be very closely watched by the market. The BOJ are currently reinvesting their maturing, the maturing securities under that portfolio holding. And that's around about the 6 trillion per month mark, 6 trillion yen per month of purchases that essentially keeps the balance sheet flat. Our Japanese economics team in their preview, they're expecting that ultimately you will halve the pace of those reinvestments. So you will let 3 trillion per month of those bonds roll off. But that won't. That will be phased in over a period of 2 years. So it won't be something that will impact flows dramatically in the very near term. But over a two-year period, you will see a fairly significant slowdown in the pace of those purchases. That probably has been, somewhere close to the market's expectation. There's may not be a huge move in the market as a result of that. I think the detail will be important. How quickly does the reduction in those purchases begin? But we're not expecting a major impact on say, the long end of the JGB curve or on term premium globally as a result of that announcement. I think as interesting will be whether or not they hike or not. We think that they will. A 15 basis point hike to get to the 25 basis point policy rate mark. That is probably priced about halfway. So there will be some hawkish news to the market if they do deliver that hike. I think the question, though, from a macro perspective is just how much hawkish follow through could you get if they hike or, and certainly if they delay, because ultimately the inflation process has been cooling a little. And so you've seen the most recent inflation numbers coming out of Japan a little bit lower than expected. And so in that sense, there's not a huge amount of, near-term momentum in inflation to get a very hawkish message. And yet, over time, we do think the underlying inflationary pressure from higher wages will start to propagate through the economy. On a more long-term basis, we can see the policy rate moving higher. Our Japanese economics team expect that to be over 1% over coming years. And as a result, we still remain structurally quite bearish on the JGB market. But next week, it does seem you don't quite have the momentum in the data to see a lot of hawkish follow through. And I think that, as you mentioned, the yen, I think, will be in focus. We've seen a big appreciation in recent sessions from the big weakening we've seen throughout the year. I don't think that will necessarily change the outlook a lot, but it is one thing to remember that if there has been progress on inflation so far, a lot of it has come through a weaker yen and tradables inflation. And I think the BOJ will be a little reluctant to see a significant strengthening because that might undo some of the work that they have done on inflation. And that kind of limits the degree to which they will be willing to surprise very hawkishly or very dovishly as we go through next week's meeting.
Thanks very much, George, as always. Now I'd like to welcome Michael Cahill onto the call. Michael is our senior currency strategist. Michael, first question for you, just focus on the U.S. We've obviously seen a lot of fluctuations in the dollar with the news coming out across the U.S. election, with Biden announcing on Sunday night that he would no longer be running, and obviously Kamala Harris looking like the expected candidate. Could you give us a sense of how this has impacted the dollar over the past week and your outlook for the fall?
Yeah, thanks. So I think if we sit back on the dollar over the last over the course of July, like I think there have been a few distinct phases. So I think the biggest initial mover was kind of unwinding some of the political premium that we had put into the dollar, not from the U.S. side, but actually from the elections that we had in the rest of the world in June. As the market digested that news, then we saw the reversal in things like the Mexican peso and the euro. And that was really then driving the initial phase of the dollar weakness in July. Then we had some period of where slower growth news sort of emboldening the Fed and firming up those expectations for Fed cuts coming at the later this year, as George was talking about. And, you know, but during that period, that is when we saw Trump's odds going up. So we got a lot of questions on whether we have the Trump story wrong and whether it actually is negative for the dollar. I don't think so. I think it is more that the market has to trade the present environment before we can trade, you know, theoretical tariffs that would be at least 6 months away, but and probably substantially longer than that. But now I think what has shifted for the most part over the last week is that even as as the market is turning more towards growth concerns, then first of all, even in the abstract, that is not that negative for the dollar. Dollar is still a safe haven currency. But I think the bigger issue is that it's not really U.S. growth concerns. When I look at the imprint across FX markets, I think it is much more a rest of the world kind of growth concern, less so on the U.S. side that's being reflected in FX markets. I think that also helps solve, you know, some of the mystery, some of the questions we've had around, you know, why is the market getting more worried about growth when actually the U.S. data have been pretty good over the last few weeks, at least relative to expectations. And I think it's because it is the lack of stimulus in China, the disappointing GDP print out of China, and then the weak European PMIs. I think that is having a bigger impact. And at least when I look at, you know, what currencies have moved the most, I think it is more from that, and that as we turn to maybe more of the growth or like growth concerns driving central banks, then I think that it is still the U.S. coming out a winner in that environment. Now, then there are some idiosyncratic factors laying on top of that. Of course, the big mover this in the last couple of weeks has been on the yen side. Some of that started with the Trump Business Week article. Now, we are very skeptical of the ability to do a quote-unquote currency deal. I think the market, the FX market in 2025 is very different from the FX market in 1985 with the Plaza Accord. But I think that what that revealed was some momentum going into the yen had weakened substantially and substantially further than what other cyclical factors were showing. And so some of that is coming just unwinding. Then I think we see the safe haven effect of the yen playing a role. But mostly I would put that down to idiosyncratic factors, but that does help sort of reveal that part of what the market is questioning here is the higher for longer type of environment and starting to question some of that growth coming in. That does affect the yen more than others. But I think that the overall picture when this settles out is one that is not that different from where we were a few weeks ago. I think the market moves have been larger than our assessment of the fundamentals, and so I think that those sort of dynamics that we've had for much of the year, keeping the dollar strong going into the election, I think those will still be in place. And I think that really the bottom line to your question is I think the market is having to trade the shifting news on the growth outlook before we can trade the perhaps tectonic shift coming from politics, which will be at least several months down the road.
Thanks, Michael. So just looking more broadly, what are your more favored trades in the FX space?
I think that the recent moves have given some opportunities to look at to restrike trades at better levels. So our overall framework has been that the dollar would remain fairly well supported and elevated heading into the election as trade uncertainty picks up.
And I think that that is you know, that is still the broad framework, and should intensify now as we move closer and closer to the event. But I think I would characterize the trades we're thinking about now in two ways. One is looking at the types of trades that where say that we are still in that generally higher for longer type of environment, and so I think that the at least on the U.S. side, and so where does that impact FX? I think the biggest one here is dollar yen. We're thinking about at what point do we want to re-enter that. I think that that is still an options trade to me. Things like call flies or and the like. I'm just saying that I think that the carry is still very, very much in your favor. But I recognize, you know, it has been a big move. And that's why I think that this is more in option space. A similar one along those lines, I would say, is on Norway. Again, one that really gets punished when equities are moving down together with commodity prices. But this has been a pretty extreme move now in Norway. And I think that some of the options there look attractive, and if we do find some stabilization in the broader growth narrative, I think that that is one that can bounce back, because I think the currency has moved more than the news has. And then the other types of trades is thinking about, you know, where the current macro lines up with the potential outcomes from the U.S. election. Here, I think euro dollar is most top of mind. You know, we've seen the very negative PMIs coming out last week. I think that it is only going to be a matter of time before the ECB shifts to more of a growth outlook than looking at the spot inflation data. I thought, in particular, some signs that that employment is faltering on the service sector, that is the sort of thing that would hold back consumption and keep people from spending those pent up savings. And I think that will only be added to the trade uncertainty that is coming with the election. And so I, again, you know, would just rely on that framework that I think it is going to be very difficult for people to send significant portfolio flows into Europe with this uncertainty. And so I think the risks on euro dollar skew to the downside. And then our economists have shown that the prospective policy response to the different tariff scenarios give you a very different setup for the Fed and the ECB in those. And euro dollar does tend to be you know, pretty responsive to that policy outlook. And so I think that this is a place where we can take advantage of what's been a very narrow trading range in FX and to get some, like, I think, attractive 6 and 12 month option strikes.
Thanks very much, Michael. We'd now like to welcome Don Striven onto the call, our head of oil research. Don, thanks for joining us. A couple questions for you. First, Brent prices have now dropped to early June levels. Why have oil prices and many other commodities sold off so much?
Yeah, thanks, Leah. Several key commodities, especially industrial metals, are under pressure in July, although our Goldman Sachs commodity total return index remains up a respectable 8% year to date. The recent downward pressure on commodity prices reflects three key factors. Number one, concerns about growth, especially in China, with Q2 sequential growth slowing below 3%, still weak domestic demand, especially in the property sector, which is critical for several base and ferrous metals. But softer PMIs in Europe, and to a lesser extent, questions about the US labor market data, have also contributed to some growth concerns. The second factor is that we are seeing a very large reversal of massive financial inflows that we had in the spring earlier this year into the base metals complex, especially copper. Investors piled into copper in the spring, as bullish long-run fundamentals such as weak mine supply and solid green demand growth got priced in. And some investors expressed the AI team through long copper trades. But the challenge is that commodities are largely spot assets and typically price the short-term fundamentals as opposed to the multi-year ahead outlook. The other challenge is that China apparent commodity demand is very price elastic in the short term, and Chinese copper buyers have been switching to cheaper substitutes. And finally, the other challenge is that the AI team is running out of steam, also in equity markets, and quantitatively, AI was never really a big driver of the bullish long-run copper demand picture. Third, turning to oil specifically, Brent crude oil prices have edged down from near the top of our $75 to $90 per barrel range about a month ago to basically the middle of our $75 to $90 range right now. The contributing factors are weakness in China demand data and growing investor interest in the idea that a potential second Trump term may lead to much lower oil prices.
Thanks, Don. So just on that, you know, we're thinking about your forecast of $75 to $90 per barrel for Brent this year. What do you see as the key risk for that? I know you referenced U.S. elections. Can you elaborate on that and any other risks you see?
Great. So we still forecast a $75 to $90 range. Given our base cases of trend-like growth in global GDP and oil demand, assuming steady U.S. policies, and our base case that OPEC will continue to balance the market and stabilize prices. We just published a piece on the risks to this $75 to $90 call from a potential second Trump term with three key conclusions. Number one, implied oil price volatility, which is currently at near record low levels, could pick up because of large two-sided US policy risks to oil prices, with significant downside risk to prices from tariffs and some upside risk to prices from lower supply in sanctioned producers such as Iran. The second takeaway from the piece is that on net, we do think that the US policy risks to oil prices skew to the downside. The key reason is that very high spare capacity in the oil market makes it easier for core OPEC producers to absorb tightening shocks, such as lower round supply, by filling in the shortfall by producing more. That's easier to absorb than easing shocks because current production levels from countries such as Saudi Arabia and the UAE are already quite low. We, for instance, look at the scenario where the US were to impose an across-the-board tariff of 10% on US goods imports, and where the Fed were to delay cuts beyond 2025 because of higher core inflation. In that scenario, we estimate that Brent falls into the low 60s per barrel as a result of weaker GDP and weaker oil demand. The third takeaway is that because implied volatility for crude oil prices has dropped to percentile 9 over the last 25 years, options on oil prices are now quite attractively priced to hedge price risks, especially 2025 oil price downside.
Thanks, Dan. And then final question for you. What are your highest conviction commodities right now?
Gold on the bullish side and long-dated international gas prices, basically in Europe and Asia, on the bearish side. Starting on the bullish side, we see significant value in long gold positions and maintain our bullish forecast of 2,700 for 2025 gold prices. That's basically 14% higher from the spot price. Three reasons there. We believe that, number one, the tripling in central bank gold purchases that we have seen since mid-2022 on fears about sanctions and the US sovereign debt outlook, that tripling is structural and is here to stay and will support demand. Second, Fed rate cuts, which are highly likely now, are poised to bring Western capital back into the gold market. And third, from a hedging perspective, we do think that gold offers some very significant hedging value to investor portfolios against geopolitical shocks, including trade tariffs, the risk that the Fed may become subordinated because of pressure from the White House, and also broader fears about the debt outlook. Turning to our highest conviction on the bearish side, my colleague Sam Dart expects major downside pressure on European and Asian gas prices during the second half of this decade because of a very sharp increase in global LNG supply. As we expect LNG supply to basically increase by 50% by the end of the decade, we believe that European gas prices, TTF prices, will be forced below brown coal economics, which is basically at 21 euros per megawatt hour, to prevent a massive oversupply. And so we do think that selling long-dated European gas prices is an attractive way to express this bearish view on gas prices in Europe and Asia.
Thanks very much, Don. I'll now hand the call back to Mark.
Leah, and to all our other speakers, thank you very much indeed. That's it for this week's call. Have a good week in markets. We will be back again next weekend for one final call before we have a short break over the summer. Wish everyone a good week, and we look forward to speaking again next weekend.